At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Saving money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, including pouring a walkway, setting a post, or even installing stone veneer. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Tom, you know what sucks?
What's that?
Buying a car. And it shouldn't, but it does. And in this podcast, among other things, we're going to talk about the top seven reasons why buying a car sucks, both new and used, I fear.
Yeah, and we're also going to talk about some of the cool things we've got kicking around the office. Like, I just had a little bit of an off-road adventure in the Ford Bronco Sport and the full-size Ford Bronco. And we also, I want to talk about our side-by-side adventure with the Polaris Expedition, where we almost rolled it over. That was
twice. We almost rolled it over twice. I've had more butt pucker moments in that thing than I have in the last 5 years in one trail. So we'll get to that as well.
And also an update on our military truck, I think would be cool. Our M35A3 that we just bought.
Isn't that something that Andre should be doing over at the truck podcast?
Well, Andre didn't take it to the 4th of July celebration.
Oh, you took it to the 4th of July celebration.
I did. Do you want to start with that?
Sure, let's start with that.
So we've got this old military truck, right? And what it is, it's called an M35A3. And it's basically the six-wheel, two-and-a-half-ton truck that you'd see in movies like Indiana Jones. And then there's a company called Boyce that bobs off the rear wheel and then restores them and puts in AC. And basically, they sell you a huge kind of Tonka truck.
Military truck, yeah, decommissioned.
Decommissioned that you can then drive on the road. The problem is, what is it actually like to drive on the road? So I've been kind of driving it around a little bit around the ranch and drove it to our 4th of July celebrations with all our friends in the back. Turns out this truck is awesome.
Yeah,
it is so much fun.
When you bob the truck, you actually make it about the same size as like a 3500.
Yes.
Except exactly. Much taller.
Right. It's like 9.5 feet tall.
But in terms of parking and in terms of like getting around, it's not horrible, especially since ours has an automatic.
Yeah, it's actually really good. So these trucks, I just did a video over at TFL Classics where Case and I went through the entire truck. But they built these from 1949 through 1999. So a 50-year production run of these trucks. And they had all sorts of different engines and transmissions. Now ours is kind of right toward the end of the production run. So we've got a Caterpillar diesel engine in line 6. 3116, makes about 170 horsepower. It's got a 4-speed automatic, and ours has power steering, right? It's got good air-assisted brakes, really easy to drive, and then you just sit so tall, you look over everybody and everything. It's really cool.
That's not ours.
That is ours, actually.
Is it?
That's what it looked like before. Yep, that's our exact truck.
That's before, huh?
So this company called Boyce, you can kind of see in this video, they take this truck, which is pretty rough around the edges, right? It's you know, spent a lot of time outside at a base. It's got bad paint. It's got bad interior. It's got this sketchy wooden box on the back of it. And then they paint it. They go through the interior. They put new seats in it, new electronics.
If you get the off-road video, Cole, we do a walk around in it.
Or TFL Classics. I just did one this weekend.
There you go.
That's a good one.
That's what it looks like afterwards.
So I loaded up the back of the truck with some of my friends.
Oh, my God. That looks so much better, doesn't it?
Uh-huh. Total transformation.
That is a total transformation. And it still looks huge, but footprint-wise, it's not that horrible.
You know, in pictures and in person, you see it and you'd say, oh, my God, this thing is never going to fit down the road. But it is legal width, and more importantly, it's legal length, and it fits perfectly in a parking spot. So you even have a couple inches to the white lines on either side.
Now, there is a little bit of a disclaimer here. We were able to get it titled, but we had to do it in Utah because Colorado doesn't like registering decommissioned military trucks. But Utah doesn't care, so thank you, Utah. And by the way, if you're wondering how we manage that, we own some property in Utah. We have a bureau in Moab, and that's why we were able to
license. Well, it's we have the world's smallest apartment in Moab.
It's a TFL bureau.
25 square feet of condo in Utah, exactly. Bureau. No, so the thing about these trucks, you're right. You can buy them on Facebook for like $8,000. $4,000 to $10,000 will get you one. But they almost always are basket cases without titles. What Boyce does is they get them direct from the government, and then they're able to title them with a Utah title. So that we just brought it to the Moab DMV, said we want to register this. They handed us plates, and we were out on the road. And then once you have license plates, you can drive it wherever you want. So it's not illegal to drive it in Colorado. It's just very hard to register in Colorado.
Yeah, same reason you can't do Humvees here.
It does have a couple issues.
What are those?
It's very loud.
It is. I wear ear protection.
So you're supposed to wear ear protection in it, and part of it's because the box is the cab is kind of just a big tin box, right? There's no carpet or sound deadening in there, which is something we could add. And apparently, it's supposed to make it much nicer to drive around the inside because it's less loud.
And then the exhaust is right by the passenger side.
It's 2 inches from the passenger window, so all of the noise is piped right into this little tin box that you're immersed in. But I'm absolutely in love with the way this thing drives. It's actually not that slow. So the roads around me have about a 45-mile-an-hour speed limit, which is perfect for this truck, right? It's happy about 40 to 50. And then Andre maxed it out on the highway and got it up to 55, but it's really screaming at those speeds. But, you know, around 40 to 45 is right where it's perfect. It's surprisingly comfortable. We put some cushions in the bed so my friends could sit down on the cushions, and it gets a ton of attention, a lot of waves and smiles. No one's really upset with it because, yes, it's slow, but it's so childlike in kind of how it goes down the road that people aren't pissed about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you said, Tommy, it's a giant Tonka toy, and I'm just waiting for some deep snow to really take advantage of it.
The interesting thing, too, is that they're – if you get them through Boyce, even fully restored like this, they're not that expensive. So we have 46-inch tall tires, which was an option. We have the 16,000-pound winch, which was an option. You can paint them whatever color you want. We've got AC was an option, right? And a couple other things, a rear locker.
Headliner.
Yeah, we spec the rear locker on it. And I think if you were to do that today, the price has gone up a little bit. It would be about $45,000 to $50,000. Which seems like a lot of money for a toy, and it is. But compared to like any kind of new pickup truck, I mean, that teeny tiny GMC Canyon you bought was $55,000, right? So it's not that outrageous. Like a Unimog, if you wanted to go to J Couch and buy a Unimog, that's going to be $400,000 or $500,000. So I think $45,000 to $50,000 for this massive chunk of metal is really pretty good.
Yeah, I think it was a hell of a good investment. And like I said, I can't wait for some deep snow to have a little snow wheel in front.
I'm not sure those tires are going to be very good in the deep snow.
Yeah, but the ground clearance is going to be exceptional.
The problem is, so I really want to take this thing off-road, right?
Uh-huh. I just need some place like Moab where we took it off-road in this video where there's no trees. Well, Colorado's not great.
And the width is a problem. It's not so insane where you're out of options. But the height is another issue because you're 9.5 feet tall, right? So you got to find trees that don't encroach at the top. And then the other thing about it is that, like we said, it's not that fast. So if we wanted to take it to like let's say Idaho Springs, right? Yeah. The trails around there. You can't really go up I-70.
You have to go the back way, but it'd be kind of fun.
Yeah, you'd have to plan probably another hour or two of commute time, right, to get where you're trying to go.
Well, that's what the Army does.
Yeah, that's true. They go at 50 miles an hour for hours and hours and hours with ear protection on. But I think that this truck is super cool. People are really happy to see it, and I like it a lot. Now, this is called a Deuce and a Half, uh-huh. right? You can also get a 5-ton version of this.
Yeah, that's going to be impossible.
Which is even bigger.
Yeah.
They also bob those. Those ones have an even cooler look because the front ends are just
straight
like a vertical cliff. But those ones are a couple thousand. They're not that much more expensive because people can't park those.
Yeah, or like when we brought it back from Salt Lake, we actually towed it back. That one's too tall, so you couldn't even, unless you had one of those low deck trailers that, you know, semis have.
Yeah,
you couldn't get it on American highway with its height restrictions.
The funny thing about this truck is, I think if it breaks, when it breaks, we're gonna have to fix it ourselves because I don't know who we would take it to. The good news is, though, they look like very simple machines. Like, I've seen them all torn apart, and there's not a lot to them. You've got very heavy-duty basic axles, leaf spring suspension, not a lot of electronics in these things. So I think it's something we could probably service and fix ourselves if we had to. The tricky part, though, is you have to stand on top of it to get to the engine. Right? Like on a typical car.
You need like one of those Mission Impossible where they lower you down.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, like a harness where they lower you down from the ceiling.
You need a helicopter. So you spend a lot of time standing on it instead of standing around
it. All right. Well, let's stop talking about trucks because we are really encroaching on Andre's territory. Let's start talking about cars. First, some breaking news, which I think is actually good news for EV car buyers. As you know, Congress passed President Trump's big, beautiful bill. People probably have a hard time with that. And one of the things that was in the bill was that they did away with incentives for EVs.
Why is that good news?
Hold on. Let me finish. Okay. And they did it sooner. I was listening to some podcast, and they were like, maybe we can extend it for a year. No. September 30th, all the incentives go away.
Yeah. At least federal, right?
Yeah.
Can they take away state incentives?
No, you can't take away state.
That's up to the state.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. But
the $7,500 federal.
Federal. And the lease loophole is also gone. So all that is gone.
Okay.
So the lease loophole got you that incentive over time. If you leased it, it also did away with the restriction on income. Mm-hmm. So rich people could buy them. But the good news is that the dealer council says that there are about 140,000 EVs, new EVs, on the ground as we speak.
Uh-huh.
And I promise you that in the next 2 months, you're going to see some screaming bargains while the incentives are still around for people who want an EV. So if you're looking for an EV, I can't think of a better time to either buy one or lease one than either this month or next month or before the end of September when those incentives go away, because I'm thinking that it's just going to be a free-for-all. And right now, EV leases are already crazy. I mean, you got one for no money down, no money per month just based on the taxes.
Yep.
But you know, things like I think the IONIQ 5, the IONIQ 6, which are just wonderful EVs, I think those are going to be out there and available for, you know, Starbucks money. So if you want an EV, this is the time to get one.
So I'm looking at some of the least. So for a while there, I think that the best deals, and I do mean this, the best car deals that I'll ever see in my lifetime happened at the end of 2024. Which is when we saw like our $10 Nissan Leaf, our $0 Fiat 500, right? Our $40 Fiat 500s. Right now, they're actually they got a little bit more expensive. So, like, have you driven past our Nissan dealer in Boulder?
Yes.
It is an insane visual right now because they have more Arias on that lot than I've ever seen.
And the reason for that is because Colorado has some of the highest state incentives.
Yes.
And so we're getting a lot of EVs dumped on our shores, which is really good for EV buyers here because they're super discounted. But think about this, Tommy. 140,000 EVs on the ground with a very substantial tax benefit going away at the end of September.
But they're not as cheap as they were.
No, but this is before. None of this is filtered down through to incentives yet. That's going to take, that law was just signed, that bill was just signed into law, 3 days ago? So it's not going to be, you're not going to see it reflected in current lease options. Give it a week or two, and it's going to be a feeding frenzy out there. And I also think that in some ways, getting rid of that incentive is going to be good for EV sales, because I sincerely believe that as an around town car, let's face it, Americans, for the most part, have two vehicles.
Sure.
As an around car, there is no better vehicle than an EV. It's just so much easier to live with. I don't want to go, beat this dead horse, but no reason to ever go back to the dealership because there is very little, if any, maintenance. You don't need to put oil in it.
Not according to the Fiat dealer that called me.
I know. Well, that's a whole other story. That's a dealer thing. That's not a real thing. No oil to change. No fluids to change.
I mean, there's still stuff that wears out. Like, you'll still have to do suspension, brakes,
but that's
tires.
Over a lot of miles.
Yeah, probably not in the lease period.
Not the usual. Every 10,000 miles, you got to go in and get stuff changed and fluids refilled and changed and so forth and so on. So that's number one. Number two, if you own a house, if you're lucky enough to own a house or live someplace where there is a charger, it's super cheap and super efficient to do it at your place of residence versus having to go fill up at a gas station. Forget about the fact of having to wait in long Costco lines or going to sketchy gas stations. You bring the thing home, you plug it in, you wake up, it's full of gas, and you never have to go see a gas station. And if you do it at home, or if you're lucky enough to have a charger at your apartment or wherever you live, then the price is about half that of filling it up with gasoline. So I think it's also much more fuel efficient. At least budget efficient if you're actually buying it. And then there's something about an EV where it just incorporates much easier into my lifestyle. When I get in the thing, somehow it just feels more compatible with kind of the around town driving I'm doing. You just feel better just zipping around doing errands than you are in any kind of a gas vehicle where you're spewing all kinds of pollution into the air. And I feel good about that as a person. So I think that the next 3 months are going to be the golden age of EV buying. So if you've been waiting, and I don't have a horse in this race, I'm just hopefully trying to convince you that if you've been waiting to buy an EV, this is the right time to do it. And then the other thing that's good about the incentives is I think there's a lot of people that immediately turned off the idea of ever owning an EV once the government said, you have to have one by 2035, or I'm taking your Hemi out of your cold dead hands. And now that it's more of an option versus a threat or a legislative imperative, I think more people who have this natural tendency like I do, if you try to force something on me, then my first and immediate reaction is not to want it.
Sure.
You seem doubtful.
Well, I mean, look, you're speaking about this like this is going to be the golden age of EV for the next...
No, I said the next 3 months.
Yeah. What's going to happen... I mean, that's such a short amount of time.
Sure.
What's going to happen in October?
EV prices are going to go up.
And then no one's going to buy them.
I don't know.
I think that there's such a pushback from EVs. I mean, the fact... So I'm looking at... I'm on my computer here. Let me finish my thought here.
Okay.
We're looking at a Nissan Ariya right now on Tina's Nissan, okay? Mm-hmm. It's $149 a month, 36 months with $0 down. And that's a $48,000 car. That tells me pretty immediately that they have to – the only way these cars are moving is because of these crazy incentives. And that tells me that based on simple supply and demand, folks don't want these electric cars right now. And they have to do these deals to get them to go out the door.
I agree. And the question, Tommy, that I'm asking myself is if you – if you introduce better tech, let's look at this. I'm holding up my iPhone. I remember when this iPhone came out and people had flip phones.
Yep.
Immediately people said, you know, I like the fact that not only do I now can text and make phone calls, but I'm basically walking around with a little computer in my pocket so I can get online.
Mm-hmm.
I can get apps that let me do all kinds of handy-dandy things. I can check the weather, right? This was a better technology than the previous tech and phones.
Yep.
I also think that electric cars in a lot of ways are better technology than the current state of internal combustion. And I'm not just talking about like the fact that they don't have a very part-intensive internal combustion powertrain that tends to break over time or that tends to need a lot of work. I'm talking about just their performance envelope, which is much greater. I'm talking about how quiet they are to drive. So there's just a lot of benefits that EVs have.
But then if that was the case, why are they
because
not
there was
now?
So much misinformation and so much hatred that was associated with EVs. It became a political...
Yeah.
But it became political hot potato. So people, instead of making buying decisions on the merits, they made buying decisions based on whether they voted Republican or Democrat. And imagine if the same thing had happened with smartphones. If like all of a sudden progressive people said, I want a smartphone, but, and this happened to some extent, and conservative people said, no, I'm going to stick with my old flip phone because,
right,
you know,
sure,
take it out of my cold dead hands. And that's what's happened. And now that there's parity in pricing, maybe some of those people who were so dead set against the EV might actually open up their wallets and find out that the EV does fit their lifestyle, or at least
the problem
potentially.
Is you're actually, I disagree that there's not parity. EVs are so much more affordable right now They're not, it's not even close. I'm looking at this Nissan website. You can get an Ariya for far less than you can even get a basic Nissan Kicks.
Yeah.
So they're way cheaper and they're still not selling.
Yeah, that's because you've got this problem. You've got this Red Bull problem, right?
But let me finish the political thing.
Let me finish the Red Bull problem. You've got this Red Bull problem. And the Red Bull problem is when they asked the founder of Red Bull why it was so expensive, he said, well, how else do you know? How else would you know that it's good?
Sure.
And you've got that problem with the EV now. Because they're so discounted and because they're being pushed so hard, people make this automatic assumption that they're not any good, that they're crap, and so they don't even consider the option of owning them. It's like, you know, the difference between a Rolex and this Apple Watch that I have.
Right.
The Rolex doesn't do 0.05% of what this one does.
Yeah.
And yet a Rolex, you know, is going to cost 50 times more. I don't know how much Rolexes go for, depending on the Rolex. Why is that? Why is something that does...
the brand.
Because of the brand and because of the prestige.
Sure.
And right now, EVs have been kind of consigned to the scrap heap of cars, right? They're
yeah.
throwaway. They're cheap. You know, they can't get rid of them on the dealership. And human nature, when you do that, kind of automatically says, well, this is not worth my time. This is not worth my money. Instead, I want the thing that is more precious, that is more valuable. And with parity, I think that you might start to see a shifting of the buying...
No way.
Okay, well, that's...
Because the problem is that you keep saying parity. We're beyond parity. EVs
no,
are...
coming. I think it's good that EVs are going to get more expensive. Price parity.
Oh, they're not, Dad. I think it's going to hurt them because they're already expensive. This lease deal is cheap, right? But I could go buy the car. I could go spend $48,000 on the car, right? There's nothing stopping
me. How much is... Let's look at this. How much is a midsize RAV4...
42.
And how much would an Ioniq 5 be?
50.
Probably, if you got the base one, probably about the same amount.
Right.
So but there is no parity because the Ioniq 5 is going to get a $7,500 discount.
You're saying that the cars are going to sell better because they're going to get more expensive.
I'm saying potentially it might. The reason that EVs aren't selling to a lot of people is because of the perception. Not because of the reality, because
sure.
of the perception. And if you change the perception, you can change the reality. I'm looking at this as a glass half full as opposed to a glass half empty. Now, most people would say that the biggest reason people make a buying decision is based on cost, and I'm not disputing that.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping that at some point when there's, you know, a lot of used EVs on the market and people come to the dealership and decide, well, I need a second car. Maybe this EV that's there because, you know, right now it's much cheaper than the gas car. People will buy that thing, they'll get into it, and they'll be like, you know what, this thing isn't as bad as I thought. And some people find the exact opposite. Some people say, I hate this thing, and you know, that's fine. But I like free market, and I like parity, and I'm hoping that the free market will do well for EVs.
I think what we're going to see is an absolute cratering of the EV market.
Well, that's what people are saying,
because,
Tommy.
Dad, what you're arguing is true, right? The cars are better, but they're better now. Nothing's going to change in 3 months. They're just going to get more expensive. The used cars are already dirt cheap. You can already get
the perception is that they're not better. The perception is...
I know, but why would that change if the tax credit goes away?
Because all of a sudden they're going to get more expensive.
They're already expensive.
No, they're not expensive. No, in real terms, they're not expensive. Don't look at the sticker. Look at the thing that you're actually paying. People are smarter than that. They don't look at the sticker. They see how much money they're actually paying.
But if they were smarter than that, they would see that it's a better car for less money now. So why would I get the gas?
No, they don't. It's like I said, it's a Red Bull problem. It does. The perception of what it is more important than the reality of what it is. And right now, the perception of EVs is that they're crap and that they're throwaway and that they're junk.
So they're going to be better when they are expensive crap.
It might. It might actually. Because people value... what they pay for something.
I think we're going to see a cratering of the...
That's what everybody's saying, but we'll find out.
If the cars aren't selling when they're cheap, why would the same car sell when it's more expensive?
Because it's not about...
The perception is then this car...
The reason they're not selling is because half America thinks that, you know, this has something to do with their politics.
And that's not going to change in 3 months. Why would that change in 3 months?
Well, you know what'll change it?
What?
Gas prices.
Gas prices would have an impact on EV sales.
Gas prices.
I 100% agree.
And I've lived long enough to know the gas prices, you know, ping pong up and down. I remember when, you know, your mom bought her Prius when gas got to be $5 a gallon. And there will come a time in the not so distant future where gas prices will go up because this is what gas prices do. Whether it's some, you know, kooky idea that some dictator has somewhere to invade a country or because of some natural disaster, gas prices will always go up. And if that happens, then EV sales are going to become much more resilient than they are today. Right now, I think the hardest thing that people are fighting is the fact that there's price parity, or in some cases, gas is cheaper than electricity. But if that flips, and that will happen, Tommy, yeah, then all of a sudden EVs will become more in demand.
Gas prices will impact it, but I just don't believe that saying the car is going to be more expensive is going to make it seem like a more premium good. What you're going to end up with is people saying the car was already undesirable, and now it's undesirable and overpriced. That's the opposite that can happen, right? I mean, it's easy for a company like Rolex or Red Bull to say we're charging premium prices because they're also a premium brand, right? They're selling a premium experience. A Nissan Ariya is not considered by anyone to be a premium experience.
Yeah, but the people who build these cars understand that, Tommy. And that's why, for instance, the Rolls-Royce, what's the electric one that I just tested?
The Spectre.
The Rolls-Royce Spectre is selling very well, and it's selling to a much younger audience than most Rolls-Royces. I want to say the medium age of a Spectre buyer is in the 40s, which is unheard of
because of China. Because of China.
No, worldwide, not just China.
But China is what drives Rolls-Royce.
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's just China.
I just heard a podcast about this. China is what drives the Rolls-Royce market, and especially young people in China, right? And it's easy to say that the Spectre selling, not because it's electric, but because it is a Rolls-Royce. That already is a premium good.
But the other Spectres aren't selling. The ones that are selling are the Spectres. You know, it's hard to, let's put it this way, piss into the wind when the wind is blowing EV. And at the end of the day, electric cars are just better at being cars than, I'm going to say it, it's true. They're just better cars than internal combustion. They may not be more fun. You know, they may not tow better. And right now, they may not have more range. But give it 10 years, they're just a better car.
They're better if you can charge them at home. They would not be better for someone like Cole, our videographer.
10 years ago, you know, EAs were just starting to come out, and Tesla had its own network. Today, the Tesla supercharging network is open to most manufacturers. These things will change.
And I would argue...
And also, change, you know, charging is quickly improving. Battery technology is quickly improving. Give it 10 years, and an EV will have more range than an internal combustion car. Unless you fill it with, you know, a boat ton of gas.
But I'm not sure that's going to matter. I really don't, because unless you have a place to charge it up at home, people don't want to stop and charge.
What you're arguing is for the flip phone.
I am arguing for the flip phone because there are instances, Dad, plenty of cases throughout history where the worst technology failed and the better technology
won.
Right,
but that wasn't worldwide. Worldwide, the better technology usually wins, and that's because, you know, a lot of technology is driven by, let's face it, by war. And in war, it doesn't matter what your political beliefs are. If you can create a bomb that blows up more people, whether you believe that bomb is...
does it have to do with my Ariya?
What it has to do with is what I'm trying to make the case for.
My Ariya is going to explode?
Better technology always ends up winning, because if you sit and hold on to the old technology, somebody will come along, whether it's in war or in commerce, because commerce oftentimes is war, and they will wipe your ass away until you can no longer sell that car. So if GM... is forced to, in America, because this is a worldwide industry,
right?
Is forced to build internal combustion cars because of whatever, you know, the market says here, but the rest of the world goes electric, then GM's not going to be around very long. And that's the same for Ford, and the same, and these people realize this because these are worldwide companies, Tommy.
Yeah, but I think that the market also has a big impact on it. Just because they're going electric in China doesn't mean we're going to go electric in the US.
I'm going electric in Europe too.
Yeah, but doesn't mean we're going to go electric in the U.S.
But I'm saying, as a worldwide company, you can't build and make a profit.
But if GM sells the majority of their cars here, the vast majority.
They don't.
Where do they sell the majority of their cars?
GM sells cars worldwide. They build
cars. But they sell the majority of their cars here. Look, Dad, I just think that it's naive to say because a better technology is better, it's going to win. Because there's other forces in favor of the worst technology.
All it takes is $5 a gallon gas, Tommy.
And we've seen it. For example, I saw a really interesting documentary piece about Betamax versus VHS, right? VHS won that by a huge margin, right?
And you do realize that petroleum and oil is a finite resource.
I understand that. But VHS won that argument by won the competition by a huge margin, right? Nobody remembers Betamax. Everybody, but yeah. If you look at the objective technology between VHS and Betamax, Betamax was a better format. VHS won because it was cheaper.
It didn't win the war. It won the battle, Tommy. You could win the war.
So Betamax might be coming back.
Digital won the war.
I know, but
which is
I'm
better
saying,
technology than Beta or VHS.
I understand
you see
that.
What I'm saying? But so you win the battle, but you still lose the war.
In that period. The VHS won, even though Betamax was in a lot of ways a better technology. I would argue that back in the turn of the century, the electric car in 1910 was a better technology than the gasoline car.
It wasn't. It was horrible. They had horrible batteries. They had no range. And they had horrible cars. These cars, you like face backwards to go forward. It was not a better technology.
But all cars were horrible in 1910.
No. Internal combustion engine cars were cool.
Whereas
electric cars were these cars.
And that's it. You nailed it. Electric cars aren't cool. And I'm not sure electric cars will ever be cool. That was key what you just said. They weren't cool in 1910.
A lot of people want a Tesla Model S Plaid. It's
not really.
Damn
have
cool.
you seen the resale value on Model S Plaids?
It's pretty damn cool.
If they were so cool, why are they selling for $48,000 when they were $120,000 new?
Tommy,
it's a good point.
We'll have this argument, and once again, you never address my issue.
What's the issue?
They won the battle but lost the war. Digital won over. At the end of the day, better technology, which is digital, won over. And electric. You believe electric technology is better than gas for powering cars? Let's start with that.
No. Not for everybody.
No. Period. I don't make some like, but for this or that. In general, do you think electricity is a better form of a car than internal combustion?
I'm not going to answer that because I don't think it's black and white. I don't think it's easy to say.
I think it's easy to say.
It's not.
It is.
So if you're coal, is it better?
No, not for me.
Right. So it's not better for him. It's better for my wife, but it's not better for him. It's a better technology.
I can say it's a better technology. Just because coal is an apartment complex that doesn't have electric chargers, that doesn't make it a worse technology. It just means that the infrastructure isn't there.
And
the technology is still better, but the infrastructure just isn't there. And the infrastructure will be there, Tommy.
If I have an electric weed whacker and a gas weed whacker, the electric one's better, but I can't charge it up, the gas one's better.
Once again, you know, today more people are buying electric lawnmowers than they are buying gas lawnmowers.
That's not the point I'm making.
When you were a little guy, right, we were all driving around in RC cars that were gasoline powered, right? Spend I don't know how many countless hours trying to start those things, and they would overheat, and then you would run out of that weird, you know, gas, and it would spill all over the place. And now everybody's using electric. Same thing with RC airplanes. It's just a cleaner, easier. It's just an easier technology.
With
to deal
any
with.
Kind of technology, you can simply not say one is better than for everybody.
Is
a helicopter or a plane better?
I can definitively say that a gun is better than a bow and arrow. I can definitively say that.
Okay, is a helicopter better than a plane?
They're not comparable technologies.
Well,
they're
both fly.
No, they're not, Tommy.
It's true. I mean, is a sailing?
I could definitively say that a jet is better than a prop. I could definitively say that.
I don't think you can say that.
Yeah, because
actually.
In most applications, people use jet. Sure, there are some applications where props are better, but in general, a jet is better than.
So you're saying, an EV is always better. That's
I'm
what
saying
you just
in
said.
Most. Instances an EV is better tech.
I think it's
easier, and that's the key. It's easier. It's just easier. It's cleaner. And I'm not talking about just emissions. I'm just talking about just ease of use, ease of repair, ease of everything. It's just a lot easier to live with.
For a lot of people, it's easier, but for some people, it's not. And those people's lifestyle might not change.
Sure. Right? If you're towing, EV sucks.
You live in an apartment that doesn't have charging.
Once again, it's coming.
I don't know, Dad. I think. Yeah, if you have to drive cross country, pretty big issue.
Yeah, right? But most of us don't. I mean, okay, when's the last time you drove cross country?
With TFL.
Yeah, with TFL. Uh huh. Uh-huh.
But does he drive?
Tommy, when's the last time you drove country?
With TFL.
Uh huh. Exactly.
But does Cole drive an electric car?
No, he doesn't.
Because it doesn't work for him, right?
You're using Cole as your sole argument.
I just asked Mary this question because she's been driving the Leaf. Mary loves the Nissan Leaf.
Yes.
Loves it,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And I said, so would you love it enough to own it as your only car?
Uh-huh.
She said, absolutely not.
Did I say only car? I said second car.
No, you didn't. When I started this, I said
most Americans own two cars. And as a second car, as a commuter car, it's better.
Yes, but if it was her only car, if it's better technology, she would want that as her only car.
I think the other problem with that argument is, and I just showed it, most people buy cars for what they think they're going to do with them, not for what they do with them. And I completely accept that. Mm-hmm. But everybody's like, oh, what if I need to go see Crazy Aunt Edna in Chattanooga and I've got an electric car and I can't get down? The fact is, you're probably not going to go see her. And if you are, you're going to get on a plane and you're not going to drive there. And that's where we're at. I just was at the airport. Oh, my God, it's so full. Anyway, let's get off this. I think we're boring people to death. Let's move on.
I think that you bring up a good point. People buy cars for things that they don't need them for, right?
Right.
And that is going to ultimately hinder the electric car. I talked to Mom about this, who drives an EV. She said she'd go back to gas. Mary would go back to gas. Morgan would go back to gas because they think they're going to need it. They never do, but they think they're going to need it. And that is what is going to hurt electric cars for the next 10 years, right? Unless there's a monumental shift, which could happen, where you can fill up an electric car at home in 5 minutes and get 300 miles of range, then they're going to always have that perception of being city secondary cars.
I think it's already happened. I think most people now have access to the Tesla charging network, which is, you know, by far the best network in America, and it's up 99.9% of the time. A lot of people have had really bad experiences with Electrify America, including us,
sure,
where you show up. But that never happens at Tesla. Tesla is always working.
But there's still that perception.
They're on top of it.
There's still that understanding.
But over time, as people start using the network and as they become comfortable using it and as they figure out how to use, not in California, I get it. You guys in California need a lot more chargers. I mean, there you can show up at a Tesla supercharger with, you know, countless chargers and still have to wait a long line. It's still not there, but it is getting there. All right, let's end this. I'm bored of it. I just kind of wanted to give you my take on it. Let's talk about why it sucks buying cars.
Okay.
All right. So I always think to myself, buying a car should be fun. I love cars. I love both electric and gas cars, by the way. And the best day in my life is when I buy a new car. And yet I was thinking to myself, I always dread it. Whether it's a new car or a used car, I always dread it. So I thought about, why do I dread it? And let's start with new cars. The reason I dread buying new cars is because the process is inherently time-consuming, mm-hmm, and not in a good way, right? It's not like you walk into like a jewelry shop and you pick out the exact, and I'm not a big jewelry guy, but the exact ring or something, and then you give them your credit card and you walk home with it. At a car dealership, you always feel like you're a prey.
Yes, 100%.
And I don't know why that is.
Well, because they're trying to – I mean, I think in jewelry shops you also feel like you're prey.
Okay, fair.
any time that there's, I think, a purchase that is
– it's predatory. It's a predatory business transaction.
Well, the problem is that it's a huge purchasing decision, and there's also a lot of rules and regulations associated to that.
Which have not made it better. I'll give you an example. I'll give you an anecdotal. Remember when we bought that Land Rover and this is TFL, you know, we have all of you guys listening to this podcast or watching it, you know, on Facebook, 50 million views a month, millions of views on YouTube. So we carry a pretty substantial audience when we come and do something. And you would think that people would value that, especially like dealers would value that. But when we bought that Defender 90, I found it online, which is great. It was at a dealership in Salt Lake City. I called, and this was on a holiday weekend where banks were going to be closed on Monday. So that meant that me and you could fly out there and pick it up. And I said, you know, I did the deal over the phone. We agreed on a price. And then I said, I can't bring you a cashier's check because this was a Saturday. The bank was going to be closed. It was Labor Day weekend, right? And Monday when we were flying to pick it up, the bank was going to be closed. And I talked to the manager at the dealership, and he said, no problem. You guys are TFL. We'll take a company check.
Yeah.
So get on the plane, looking forward to buying this car. Usually when we buy cars, we usually buy them either at Brighton Ford or Johnson Auto Plaza in Brighton, and that's because they know us, and I walk in there and I'm out within 2 minutes. I cut them a check, I initial a bunch of paperwork, and I'm out of there, which is just a wonderful way to buy a car. And part of the reason I can do that is because we're TFL, because we're bringing a large audience with us. But the same thing would be true in Salt Lake City. So I show up, you're looking at the car, you're doing the video, and I'm sitting there once again cooling my heels while, you know, the manager is doing whatever the manager is doing, certainly not dealing with me. And then finally the manager comes in and says, by the way, we can't sell you the car because we need a cashier's check. And I was like, I had this conversation.
Sure.
I told you. And then he said, well, I called the owner and he won't take your check. And now I'm in a position where, you know, we have to either buy the car and drive home or buy a same day ticket, get back in the Uber, fly to the airport, and just piss away my holiday weekend because what we had agreed upon, the dealership wasn't honoring. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the only choice at that point I had was saying to them, and this is why I feel bad, because most people can't do this, saying to them, you've got a choice. It's your choice. You know, I could leave here buying a car and being very happy about buying a new car, or I could leave here being very pissed off about the fact that you didn't honor the agreement that we had. And they're, you know, to their side, they were like, well, we had somebody buy a G-Wagon and they gave us a company check and, you know, it didn't bounce.
Right. That's why they're hesitant.
And I was like, that's not my problem.
Yeah, but it is kind of your problem.
No, that's your problem. That's not my problem.
Right, but that's the reasoning as to why they don't take
it. I get the reasoning, but that's, once again, not my problem. This is your problem. This is the cost of doing business.
I understand their hesitance. And this is why I think it's difficult to buy a car.
Why do you understand they're going back on the agreement we had?
Was wrong. They shouldn't have either accepted the check in the first place or said we can only do this for a cashier.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
Going back is a problem, but I understand fundamentally why they wouldn't in the first place.
Then they should have made that clear.
For sure.
And I wouldn't have bought the ticket, and I wouldn't have bought the car.
Right.
This is bait and switch, basically.
Yeah, that was bait and switch. But that was fundamentally not an issue with buying the car. There was a problem with that dealership.
But
right?
it's an example of why buying cars suck, because it took what would have been a really wonderful moment in my life, buying a new car with you and then road tripping it back home. It turned it into a very stressful and very unpleasant situation where I was forced into a corner of whether I actually want to buy this thing, and I was forced to threaten somebody with making a video that, you know, would have exposed this. And this is me talking, you know, where I feel very fortunate to be able to have this audience that we carry with us. And if you don't have that audience and you're in that same corner, what do you do?
You have to get a cashier's check.
But they told me that I didn't need a cashier's check and I couldn't get one.
Or you just don't buy the car.
Yeah.
Right? And luckily there's enough, we're in such a free market that you've got other options, right? You can go to other dealerships. I mean, the bigger problem here is that this particular dealer was just unethical, right? They went back on their word. I mean, I think the reason that it's so difficult to buy a car at any dealership is because it's such a large amount of money, and that transaction is ripe for fraud for both the buyer and the seller in that case, right? You've got buyers that are trying to get away with buying cars with money they don't have, and you got sellers trying to sell you cars that are potentially faulty to begin with.
You know, I've gotten to this point right now after 15 years where I don't think I would buy a new car from a dealership that I have not dealt with before.
I agree. Yeah, because and it's not just that dealer. There's always something that involves some fight or some discussion. It's an incredibly stressful experience, and that's why I think companies
you should talk about your experience with F5. How many times did you have to go back and sign the paperwork?
Exactly, right.
When you got that 500E?
Exactly. I mean, when I leased my car, I had to go back 3 or 4 times to re-sign the paperwork. Because it was just, in my opinion, incompetence. They didn't know how to do the paperwork. And granted, it was a deal that they hadn't done before. This essentially a free Fiat lease, and they messed it up a couple times. But I would make the argument: why are you offering a deal you don't know how to do, and then make me come back 3 times to re-sign the paperwork?
And how long did it take you to lease that car? How long were you at the dealership before?
Like 8 hours.
Yeah.
And that was also unacceptable. And that's because there were credit checks, and then I had to get a co-application. And then it was just a lot of time sitting around waiting for the finance people to get their stuff together, which clearly they didn't do. I mean, I think that with the rules and regulations set up to buy cars in this country, especially from dealership, there are – and I took the dealer class in Colorado – is that there are so many things you have to know how to do and do it correctly, and people just don't know how to do it, right? And they go into it without that knowledge on how to do it. Right, and then you're also involving banks and the car company finance institutions, and they all have to talk to each other on the same day at the same time, or you end up waiting for 8 hours to not buy a car. Right, the best way to buy a car from manufacturer is through a direct sales model, like a Tesla or a Rivian plan, where it's all done through the organization. Right, they take care of all the paperwork in house. They know how to do it because they've done it 100,000 times with just that car. And then you go through the online portal. You set up financing through Rivian or through Tesla. You show up, take delivery, and drive out of there.
So when we bought our Tesla Model 3, the first one, mm-hmm. That experience was actually pretty good. We went to the store. Mm-hmm. This is now 10 years ago, I think.
Yep.
And there was a guy who said, hey, let me walk you through it.
Yep.
And then he kind of showed me everything about the car. But by the time we bought the last one, which was a Cybertruck, basically I walked in the store, handed him a check. He said, the truck is around the back. It's yours. That was it.
which I think a lot of people preferred. I bet that a lot of people went away from that model of being walked around.
Truck was dirty.
Yeah, which is bad.
The tonneau cover sort of kind of worked.
Yep.
You know.
That's Tesla for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, and this was a $100,000 truck, mm-hmm. and I felt like I had just bought a garbage can at the local grocery store.
Well, you kind of bought one that looks like it, but the
but you see what I'm saying? There was like nothing special. This is a $100,000 purchase,
right.
And it was like, oh, here you go. Here's a check. It's out there. Have fun.
It's an interesting.
Right? I mean, at least some dealers, they'll park it someplace special.
Yeah.
When we bought the 911, remember they had the cover on it and they pulled the cover off. I felt like I had spent money on something that was unique and special and like I had earned something that was worth all the hard work I put into it. With this, it was just, there you go.
I think it's also a little bit of a generational thing.
You don't feel like getting a new car is something that should be celebrated.
If I want to celebrate on my own time, the last thing I want to do is interact with people when buying a car. Like, if I look at all of my friends, maybe Cole feels this way, but I know my wife would feel this way. Okay. She would hate having someone walk her through the features because she would say, I know how to do it. I just want to go figure it out and enjoy
the car. Mom hates that too.
Right. So, and that, but I think it's from what I see, like a lot of the older generation, not that you're old.
Yes, I am old.
But a lot of people want that kind of like feeling that they're being like waited on.
Bespoke.
Where a lot of my generation just wants to make the transaction with the least possible human interaction and then go enjoy the car by themselves, right? Like for me personally, even if I was buying that Cybertruck, I don't want somebody explaining to me how the lights work. I want to go figure that out myself, right? I just want to go in there, write you a check, and then leave as soon as physically possible.
So if you're a business and you understand that this is a generational, mm-hmm. wouldn't you offer different – people hate when I use this word, but it's true – bespoke ways of, you know, if – if I walk in there and I want that walk around.
Yeah, for sure. Then I'd be like, they should have offered. And usually they do.
Here's your new car concierge. If you want, take the car and go. And if you don't want, I'll be happy to show you all the features or I'll be happy to show you some of the features.
Yeah, but they for sure should do that.
Right,
yeah.
Give people the choice.
And usually they do. Like when we bought our Model Y, they asked us, do you want us to show you how it works?
Right, but I went from the first time to the last time.
Right. So they should offer that. I agree that, and for certainly for older folks, especially with something as complicated as a Tesla,
Make it into a generational thing.
Well, it kind of is.
Don't make it into a generational thing.
I mean, look, if I gave Cole a Model 3 and said, go drive this, he would get in, figure it out and go. If I gave my mom a Model 3 and said, go drive this, she would have no idea what to do. Right. So it is a little bit of a generational thing.
But there are
thing.
Also people of your generation, Tommy, who are technologically I'm so savvy and who struggle with things.
I'm pretty bad with tech.
Not just, you know, young and tech don't necessarily go together, even though people do conflate the two, right? Some people's minds work very efficiently with technology and some people's minds don't work. And I know that because your grandma, right, ever since she was a young girl, struggled with anything that was technological. And right now it's just become, if you're young, we get it. And if you're old, you don't get it. But with her, she just didn't get tech, period.
Well, but yeah.
Because that was
but
her.
But I think she was a little
bit
of
a very good cook.
I don't know.
Everybody has different talents.
But I've never met anyone like my grandma ever before.
You're so.
She could not figure out how a power button worked, right? Like, I think of all the people in my friend group, I'm probably the worst with tech. And I'm still better than a lot of the older generation.
No, you're not bad with tech.
You should see me try to like do some stuff on my phone. It's pretty embarrassing. Morgan makes fun of me. Like every time I open up my camera, I'm always taking videos instead of pictures and doing that weird Zoom thing.
Oh, come on. You know, don't.
But it is true. I'm pretty bad with tech. And
it's
even
not just,
still.
It's not just generational. It should be something that goes across all lines. By the way, this is a little aside here. I also think that we have not done ourselves any favors by segmenting ourselves. When I was younger, there were like old people, there were young people, and there were middle-aged people. And we were just all people. Now, of course, every generation has to have a label, and that label has now stuck so that every generation identifies with whatever that label is. And I'm not sure that has done us any good because now it becomes – you've got this like all this baggage you're carrying if you're in your 20s, and you've got all this other baggage that you're carrying if you're not in your 20s. Mm-hmm. And it's not helping, I think – in the world to all of a sudden just stereotype sure. a generation based on whatever consensus that some demographic marketer has come up with for that generation. I don't think that is doing us any good. I think if you look at people are people, you know, We all bleed red, and we all have the same wants. We all have the same needs. We all have the same hopes and aspirations. And by segmenting us and saying, no, 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 we're much different based on whatever part of your life you're in, I don't think we're doing ourselves any good.
I agree. But I also don't want someone explaining how the Cybertruck works.
Fair. That's fair. But give me the opportunity.
Yeah, they should give you the opportunity. Yeah.
All right. And then there's, you know, you put your finger on it. Now, this is, now we've got two reasons. I'm going to do top seven why buying a new vehicle sucks. So that's number two, or number seven, six. So let's go to number five. And that has to do with all of the paperwork that's associated with it. And I think what's happened over time, unscrupulous salespeople have done mm-hmm. all these different things to make it painful, and then the government has stepped in to try to correct that with paperwork,
uh-huh.
and now it's become this like paperwork monster where you have to sign all this, but it's just meaningless. People sign it, but the dealers know that you're not reading it. The people who are signing it aren't reading it.
But those
it's just stuff you have to sign that doesn't actually do anything, unless of course you're called on it and the government comes in and audits you.
And but that's why you sign it, right? Like, no one actually reads Lemon Law disclosures, right? But And you don't want to read it until you need to lemon law your car, right? And then you're glad you signed it. So once again, you're right. There is way too much paperwork, but I understand why that paperwork is there. And from taking my dealer class, 9 out of 10 pieces of paper you're signing are for your protection and not for the dealer.
Sure, right? Sure. The other problem with the lemon law is that each state has a different...
Yeah, every state's going to be a little different.
And so in some states, it's relatively straightforward to lemon law your car, but other states, it's almost impossible.
But like, for example, a rule that's great in Colorado is if you buy a used car from a dealership, one of the requirements in the Denver counties to register it is it has to pass emissions, right?
Yes.
So it's the dealer's responsibility to provide you with an emissions test.
And let's talk about something that just happened where that did not work as advertised. So as you know, we just bought a Land Rover Disco 5
mm-hmm.
That is a diesel.
Yeah, and that's a good point.
And it's the law in Colorado states that you as a seller, not just the dealer, as a seller of a car, are mm-hmm. responsible. So if you're a private seller, you're responsible for making sure that car passes emissions. And if it doesn't pass emissions, you can unwind that deal.
Right.
So if you sell me your car and I take it in to the emissions, the smog place, and it doesn't pass, I can go back to you and say, hey, give me my money back. The car does not pass.
Within, I think it's a 48-hour period.
I don't know what the
period. Yeah, it's like if you wait 3 weeks to do it, you're on your own. But if you do it immediately.
So when that law first passed, the dealers would take cars and they would get them emission tested.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would give you the little slip saying that it's passed.
Yep.
Now they have condensed that into basically giving you a credit. So they give you, I think it's whatever it is, $25 or something.
Yeah.
And they make it your responsibility to go and get the car emissions. And if it doesn't pass, then you got to go back and you got to argue with them.
That one was a little different, though, the Discovery, because it was a diesel.
Yeah, and so they gave me
diesel emissions is a whole other can of worms.
But they're dealers. They should know this.
The law is the law. Yeah.
And so they gave us a credit toward what's the Colorado place called that does the emissions testing?
AirCare
Colorado. Yeah, they gave us a credit toward AirCare Colorado,
uh-huh.
except that AirCare Colorado doesn't
do the
emission test diesels.
Right.
Because to emission test a car, it's like $25 or $30. Mm-hmm. To emission test a diesel, it's like $150.
Sure, depending.
And you got to go to an independently private garage.
Depending on where you take it.
So they gave me this slip, and I look at it, and I'm like, okay, call up AirCare Colorado. Like, hey, we don't do diesels. I'm like, what the hell? This is, you know, once again, something that they should know. They're not the only diesels that they sell. This is a dealership, right? They sell used vehicles too. All of a sudden, is useless. And like, they didn't know that AirCare Colorado doesn't do diesels.
Well,
and then I have to argue with them, and then they're like, okay, yeah, go emissions test it, then send us the receipt, and then we'll pay you grudgingly.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, very unpleasant, as opposed to something.
There's a lot of steps. I'm not saying it. There's a ton of steps to buying a car from a dealer. It's always and it's usually a mess, and I think it's largely because a lot of people don't understand how it works. Even after taking that dealer class, I wouldn't feel confident selling someone a car at the dealer because there's a lot of paperwork you have to go through, a ton of it. And if you get it wrong, then you have to have that person come back and fix it, or you open up the potential of being sued or shut down by the dealer board.
And then the other thing that's great about where we buy our cars is they know that we're not going to get any of the after sale stuff. Where you go into the business manager's office and they're like, hey, do you want this warranty? Do you want this rust protection?
Sure.
Do you want this
uh-huh.
Do you want this anti-theft device that we've hidden? And so luckily they understand that we don't want that. And I think because it used to be so very competitive in America to sell cars. They made money in other ways. You know, the obvious way, and I'm not a dealer, so I don't understand this process, but I understand a little bit about it. The other way was, of course,
by screwing the buyer.
By hooking up, like you said, with banks. And then making more money actually financing the car than selling the car, which is already a problem because then instead of selling cars, you're becoming a financing corporation of some sorts.
Well, I also think it was easier to screw people back in the day because you didn't have the internet to find out what that car is worth, right? You had Kelley Blue Book, right? Imagine in the 70s, let's say I'm buying a Ford Pinto, right? And I live in Boulder. I would go to both Ford dealerships and figure out which one would give me the best price, right? And you kind of put them against each other. But you really don't know, am I actually getting a good deal on that Pinto? What is the national sales price? I can't go on Auto Trader and see, this dealer has this Pinto for this and this and this, right? So I think it was probably easier back in the day to price gouge someone based on that, right? And now it's harder to do that. And then we have the ability of the dealership to add on stuff like you're saying, like the security thing. And then the bigger problem I have with that is not them trying to do that, right? It's them trying to do that and then saying it cannot be removed. Oh, we added Safeguard on this car, right?
Or Starlink.
It's got the Colorado Sun Protection Package. Like, I don't want that. Oh, it has to be on that. Yeah. Well, who says it has to be on that? The dealer says it has to be on that, right? And that's a bigger problem. The other bigger problem I have, and this is a big one that people fall into in Colorado, especially, I don't know what it is in other states, but the dealer fee, dealer and handling, right?
Yeah, that is something that is completely arbitrary.
That is completely arbitrary based on the dealer, and it's pure profit. And more importantly, it has to be in the contract.
But, you know, the manufacturers are doing the same thing now with the delivery.
Sure. Yeah, that's also just an arbitrary number that it's just pure profit that they had on top. But then a lot of dealers around Colorado, you go to them, they have a $6.99 dealer fee.
Or $7.99.
I don't want to pay that. Oh, it has to be there.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, well then take that price out of the purchase price of the car, right?
Same thing with, like I said, manufacturer deliver and handling, right? It used to be like $9.95. And now
Destination.
And now I want to say Stellantis is at almost $2,000. The interesting one, BMW and Mini are still kind of low on their destination fees. And I think what's happening is because of the tariffs are starting to bite, the manufacturers are making the money up in different ways. And one of those ways is by jacking up the delivery and destination fees, which also makes you feel like you're getting ripped off because now you know that even though the car came from, let's say you're in Detroit and it came from Windsor across the river and it's a Stellantis product, it's 20 minutes away and they're charging you $2,000 to truck it across the river.
Yeah.
You know, it's just crazy. But you just said something, let's go to number four, which has made things worse, and that is, of course, the internet. The internet has made a lot of things worse, and one of them is buying a car. Have you noticed that if you ever go on the internet and you find a car you like at some independent dealer, they all have 5 stars. It's amazing.
Well,
it's amazing at how every small dealership has 5 out of 5 stars. And then you start reading through them and it's like, oh, I love Jim was great, blah, blah, blah. And then you finally get to one where like, don't use this dealership because they completely ripped me off. And then you don't know which one to believe. So the reviews that you once upon a time could use to actually judge whether you want to buy that car from that dealership are now useless because people have stacked the deck to make them seem like every dealer is on a level playing field, which they're obviously not.
Yeah, but the internet's also opened up so many more cars that are available to buy. Like that Land Rover we found in Salt Lake. We would never have found that car before the dealership.
Okay, but then the flip side of that is, for instance, as you know, Toyota dealerships have no control as to what's on their dealership. It's all done through, if you're in the Southwest region, whatever the distributor is for Toyota. And so the dealership takes their feed off of whatever cars are coming, which is something that's populated by the manufacturer or distributor. Uh-huh. And so if you go on a Toyota website and you see that the car is whatever.
That's annoying.
It might not be there.
It's in just, transit.
It's in transit.
But that's annoying. But it also, I mean, think about what
it's... I mean, it's more than annoying. If it's in transit and you actually drive out there and then you find out that the vehicle that you were interested in isn't there...
Well, God, I hope you wouldn't drive it. Call them first to see if it's there.
Well, wouldn't you believe what's on the internet?
No. Most people never believe what's on the internet ever.
Well, that's also a problem. This is what I mean. It just sucks. You think you'd go on the internet and you'd be like, hey, I wonder if that car's still there. And oftentimes when we were buying, you know, Stubby, right?
Mm-hmm.
They would advertise cars. Many dealerships would advertise, in this case, trucks that they didn't even have.
Sure. Which is also unethical. But that's a good – we would never have found Stubby without the internet. How would we
it took
have,
a lot of work.
But how would we have found Stubby in Idaho before the internet?
Yes, but
I would never have called that dealership.
I think
dealership.
I had to call like 15 dealerships on fake trucks that didn't exist before I found one that did exist.
I remember that. But the other thing, too, is the internet's opened up a whole new realm of used car possibilities, right? Like Facebook Marketplace and Craigslist, and I'm sure we'll complain about them in a second. But they have just transformed the used car industry, right? Before, you'd go to a newspaper, go to the classifieds, have no picture of a 1978 Cordoba, and then call the guy and try to figure out if this car is any good.
We were thinking about buying a little Volkswagen Bug, the buggy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was on Facebook, and I found one up in Wyoming, and that's pretty far for us. It's a couple hours, so I'm not going to drive up there unless I'm really confident that I want to buy the thing. And so I messaged – let's talk about private sales. I messaged the owner, I said, is this still available? He said, yes, make me an offer. And he had two pictures, Tommy.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I wouldn't buy a Costco chicken based on two pictures.
Sure.
You know, and that is also the problem where you basically end up, I like to call this the seller who knows what they have. They know what they have and make them an offer. And more often than not, I have found that what they have is nowhere near what they think they have, but is what they hope they have, if you understand what I'm saying. There's another example of that. I was looking at on Facebook. And this is on Craigslist. I was looking at a Fiat 500, a classic Fiat 500.
Yep.
Spider. And you can go on various sites. You can go to KBB. You can go to like Bring a Trailer. You can go to Cars and Biz, and you can actually see what these cars are selling for. And this guy had listed this thing for it was $20,000, and yet most of them are selling for $10,000.
Uh-huh.
And that's on me. That's not on him. But at the same time, you would think that a seller would maybe do some research, just like they would take some more pictures so that they could help sell that car. Because obviously, when they list a car at double the current market value, it's just going to sit there and it's just going to clutter up all the listings. Yeah, so I'm not sure that the internet – I think the internet has made it
easier.
At
least you know what that car looks like before, when you were calling on a newspaper and you might have a blurry black and white photo, right?
Yes, but
so you know what, and it's also free to list a car online where you used to have
not on Craigslist.
Yeah, but on Facebook where everyone does their car transactions, you used to have to pay a newspaper to post a car, right?
But there's nothing, there's just nothing. It's all wading through so much noise to be able to find that diamond in the rough if you're looking for something that is being sold privately. And you almost have to be an expert at buying cars and at asking the right question before you can even get to the point of going to look at it.
But I think it's always been like that.
Maybe.
Yeah, I just think that's how it is buying a car.
Yeah,
maybe that's sellers try to hide stuff.
And maybe you just put your finger on the thing that makes buying cars so difficult, and that is these are emotional
decisions,
they're right?
Valuable.
You lead with your heart instead of your head often. At least I do.
I mean, you're also going to... You're spending $4,000 for a car instead of $4 for a chicken, right? If that chicken's bad, I just lost $4. If the car is bad, I lost $4,000. So it's a higher risk transaction. So there's always going to be more drama involved.
And then, of course, I'm not even talking about the fact that...
I mean, try buying a house.
I'm not even talking about the fact that many people won't touch online sales of vehicles because they're too afraid, and rightfully so, that they're going to get murdered.
Yeah, for sure. But that, I mean, if I call someone in the newspaper... I'm not sure I'm more likely to get murdered online than in the newspaper.
Or ripped off, or, you know, somehow scammed.
Yeah. I mean, I think the internet as a whole has made car buying a lot better because it leads to more informed people who are able to do more research on that car and have a better understanding of the market value before they go and look at the car. And they also know what to look for than it did before the internet.
I guess the whole thing for me is... Buying a car has now, and maybe it's because we buy a lot of cars, and I'm whinging and whining about something that most people really enjoy. But for me, it's just become a lot of work.
Well, it's
a lot of work, and the reward to work ratio is not there anymore.
I think it's because you're just burnt out of buying cars.
It could be. It could be that. Yeah.
I think if you're like Cole and you buy a car once every 10 years, it's probably worth the work.
By the way, I helped Cole buy his car.
Yeah, but if you're buying a car once every 10 days, it gets a little old.
Well, maybe once every 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Before we wrap this up, let's talk about the Bronco Sport very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You just compared it to the Bronco. You had the new Sasquatch package, which makes it look pretty badass. There's a big old roll bar.
There's a brush guard on the front.
Guard,
yeah.
Bigger wheels, bigger tires. I mean, it looks pretty cool.
Yeah, so this is the Bronco Sport Sasquatch, which is the new off-road version of the little Bronco Sport. It's got bigger tires on it. It's got more skid plating. It's got some cool switches on the inside. It's actually a really impressive little crossover. So most crossovers in this category, like the Ford or like the Toyota RAV4 Woodland, is kind of just a trim package, or the CRV Trail Sport I drove, where they put a slightly different tire on it. They give it some more cladding and different paint and call it a day. But Ford really went the extra mile, including front and rear recovery points on this vehicle, to make it an actual crossover you could off-road
on
a regular
basis.
Would
you say it's the best or most off-road-worthy soft-roader you could buy?
Definitely the one that I've driven, yeah. It's much better than the Trail Sport by Honda because it's got a lot more clearance and better angles.
How about the Wilderness by Subaru?
I've never driven it.
True.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't spent much time in the – I drove the Forester briefly, and that was also very good. But this vehicle – what sets it apart in my mind is the thickness and quality of the skid plates, and the fact that it has front and rear tow hooks that are not some screw-in thing that you have to mess with. They're permanently integrated into the front and the back, and it's got a genuine off-road tire. It was a properly impressive little crossover.
How did it do compared to the Bronco Bronco?
Well, it's not on the same level. I mean, okay. It still is a single-speed transfer case. So going up some of the really steep hills, it doesn't have the torque delivery of the big Broncos. But with that locking rear differential, and granted, even compared to the big Bronco, relatively limited ground clearance, it would get up a shocking number of things that you would never attempt. I mean, what I tell people is, like, with most crossovers, it will probably do what you needed to do once or twice, but you're not looking for that experience on a regular basis. Like, you wouldn't want to take a CRV Trail Sport off-road on a weekly basis. Whereas this Bronco Sport Badlands, you could do mild to moderate trails every weekend, and the car would hold up to
it. All right, hang with me here. Mm-hmm. If the Wrangler is the off-roader and the Renegade is the baby Wrangler,
yeah,
let's say they called it the Renegade Sport. I mean, they called it the Wrangler Sport instead of the Wrangler, instead of the Renegade, sorry. How does the Bronco Sport compare to that?
Compared to the Renegade?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it's miles better.
Okay.
So. It's not even on the – I mean, the the Renegade was a cool first attempt, but it really lacked torque and it really lacked – durability, I would say, for regular off-road use, where I think the Bronco Sport is both of those.
Fair.
Yeah, it's a very impressive little thing. Yeah, and it was expensive. I mean, it's $46,000, this one.
Yeah, I mean, now you're brushing up against the Bronco.
But the question is, no doubt, the base model big Bronco is going to be better off-road still because it's got a low range. But do you want to live with cloth seats and no heated seats and a crappy steering wheel and basic steel wheels on a regular basis? Or do you want the Bronco Sport, which is going to be worse off-road, but has every single fixin' you can imagine for on-road loving?
You know what I don't get, Tommy? And this is a real head-scratcher. Why don't any American manufacturers build a Jimny? In other words, a Suzuki Samurai. Why don't they actually build a small vehicle with a low range, as opposed to like going up to that as far as possible and then not putting that low range in? Why not just build a Bronco Sport that is, let's say, 3/4 of a Bronco and make it as off-road worthy by giving it a low range, by giving it lockers, instead of doing this kind of Bronco Sport thing and trying to make it as good as possible without tying its hands behind its back and not giving it that low range? Wouldn't that make sense? I would buy an inexpensive, serious off-roader, and by serious, I'm defining it as something that has a low range, like a Jimny that they get in Europe and they get in Japan, and yet in America, we can't have it for whatever reason.
Because I genuinely think, as much as every comment said they would love one, nobody would buy one.
The Suzuki sold like gangbusters when it first came out. And it only sold in, I think, 3 states initially, and you had to line up for 6 months to get one the Samurai, and then, of course, the Sidekick came along and also had a low range.
And back in the day, for sure, it was a good seller. But there's a reason they didn't continue selling it. Because
they built the Kizashi.
No, because they built
which
the
is
Sidekick.
SX4.
Because people complained that the Samurai was too small and too impractical.
But the Samurai was tiny. That's not 3/4. That's
so
half the size.
What they did is they built the Sidekick, right?
Which was 3/4.
And then they built the Vitara. Because Americans say they want tiny four-wheel drives. But would people actually buy them?
Yes,
I don't think they would.
Because today, you've got the market segmented into much smaller niches than before. Before, people were like, I just want a sedan That's rear-wheel drive with a V8, right? That was everything. And then all this rest of the stuff was kind of silly. But now there is a genuine need and want and demand for off-roaders, and yet we don't have the one thing that most people want, which is a small, serious 4x4.
Yeah, I think that the idea is awesome, and I would love to say I would buy one, but I don't even think I would buy one.
I would buy one.
Because you know why? Morgan wouldn't let me buy one. Because your wife would get in that thing and be like, what the hell is this? And that is why... No one buys two-door.
Well, but also,
that is why no one buys two-door Wranglers. Every comment is, say, go out and drive the actual Wrangler, not this four-door crap.
I'm not saying it has to be a two-door. It could be a four-door.
I still wouldn't sell.
I think the Jimny's a four-door.
They have both. They have a two and a four-door.
Yeah, exactly.
But the two-door Wrangler is pretty close to the Jimny in terms of size. And maybe not price, but in terms of size. And nobody buys them.
And back in the day, Tommy, a mid-sized truck, this is now back when the Suzuki was new, was a tiny little thing about the size of a Maverick. Now everything has gone at least one, if not two sizes up. So you wouldn't you're making this assumption that it would just have to be tiny. It wouldn't. It could be actually small without being tiny and still have room for all the stuff that your wife wants.
A Wrangler's already too small. And a Wrangler is not that small. I just think it's one of those things. It's like when all the car enthusiasts, every time a manufacturer builds, people are like, oh, where are all the affordable sports cars, right? There's no affordable sports cars. Then Scion and Subaru come out with an affordable sports car, exactly what people want, and very few people buy it, right? It's just enthusiasts don't – they say they want something, and then when a manufacturer builds a Supra, they don't line up and actually buy the Supra. Same thing with the Z.
Yeah, but it cuts both ways. I think part of what you're saying is true, but part of what you're saying is also true, at least what I'm saying, and that is that what enthusiasts want is oftentimes a predictor of what the general public wants. And a good example of that would be the manual transmission. We've gone completely away from the manual, and I think there would be a lot of manufacturers, maybe not mainstream manufacturers, but a lot of especially high-end manufacturers that would do very well by bringing back a manual.
I don't think so, because Jeep didn't kill the manual in the Gladiator because people were buying it.
I think anybody who loves manuals would kill for a Ferrari with the manual. I think the Porsche manuals are flying off. And if you look at classic vehicles, the manuals carry a huge premium over the non-manuals.
In the classic world, for sure.
I was at Sam's Club yesterday, and there was a guy there who had the new M2 in that really cool baby blue color.
Uh-huh.
And I had to walk up to him, and I said, what do you think of the car? And the first thing he said, I love it. And I said, why do you love it? He goes, because it's got a manual. That was the very first thing he said. I'm like, don't you care that it's slower? And he goes, no, I just love how fun it is to drive. And this was a young man your age
who
afforded an M2.
Even we are hypocrites, right? Like we say we want manuals. Our Tacoma was an automatic. Our Wrangler that we
We do that because of videographers.
But that's the point. There's always a but.
No, that's not the point.
That's why people buy.
What are you saying, that everybody has a videographer that doesn't know how to drive?
But
is that what you're saying?
Everyone has a mother-in-law that comes to town once every year and doesn't know how to drive a manual. Everybody has a friend that might need to drive it that doesn't know how to drive a manual.
You're conflating a business reason.
But
for
that's the truth.
A consumer buyer.
I would love to have bought a Wrangler manual, but I wouldn't because my wife doesn't know how to drive it. That is a very
harsh.
You had
a Wrangler manual.
I know, before I met my wife, and then I sold it. That is the harsh reality of the situation. Everybody says they want it, and then there's the but. But our videographer might need to drive it. But
well, they do need to drive it.
My sister needs to drive it. She doesn't know how to drive a manual. But maybe
once again, you're conflating mainstream cars with enthusiast cars. I'm not saying mainstream. I'm not saying you go out and stick a manual in a RAV4. Hell no. That's our CRV. No one's going to buy that. I'm talking about the cars that people buy as their third or fourth car because they love cars and they're enthusiasts. And these, like I said, we have these small niches now where companies are doing very well. You know, filling in these little small niches because the mainstream niches have
gotten... I don't think there's money in small niches.
Oh, there is money in
small
niches.
Well, then why are they killing the Supra?
Well, that's a mainstream manufacturer making...
But that's a small niche, right? Why did they kill even the Camaro, which was a big niche, right?
I mean, I'll give you a niche that makes no sense, and yet it defines an entire brand.
What's that?
The G-Wagon.
That's not a niche, though.
If you think of Mercedes, the thing that people think about Mercedes is a G-Wagon. That is a niche that defines a brand.
No, it's not a niche. If people in Beverly...
CA Corvette defines an entire brand.
C8 is a niche, but the G-Wagon isn't a niche. If people in Beverly Hills are buying buying a G-Wagon to drive to Erewhon, that's not a niche. That's when
a niche becomes mainstream.
C8's a little bit of a thing. And once again, C8 Corvette's a good example. Everyone got all upset when they killed the manual, and they sell more C8s than almost any other generation.
Yeah, because it's mid-engine. Well, not because it's missing a manual. They would sell even more if they put a manual back into it.
I don't think anyone would buy it. It's like C7s.
Every time I listen to a conversation with like the chief engineer of Corvette, yep. The first question that always, when are you getting a manual?
But once again, C7 Corvette, right? C7 Corvette had a manual transmission.
A stupid 7-speed. I hate 7-speed.
But Dad, that was a manual transmission, and people didn't buy it.
I love manual. Tommy, once again, a little perspective here. I love manuals more than life itself. I love manuals. And yet, having driven on the same day, mm-hmm. a 911 with an automatic and a manual, and having a chance to buy a 911, yeah. I bought it because the 7-speed was so stupid. I hate the 7-speed. It wrecks the manual
for
me.
Then don't use 7.
No, it just sits out there. It does nothing.
So
there's
then
no
don't use it.
No, I don't like it. I don't like having it. I'm very OCD, right? I like things that match up, like, you know, divide by two. I don't understand that seventh
gear.
What's wrong with
you like 5 speeds. That doesn't match up.
Yeah, because 5 is perfect. It works. 7 just doesn't work. Sorry, that's me. And I think there's a lot more people like me where the 7-speed is just stupid. It makes no sense.
I don't know about that.
It just makes it a drudgery to shift.
Well, why didn't we buy a manual Bronco?
Because of the videographers.
But there's always a but.
Yes, it's a business.
There's always a but.
It's a business.
I just think... Right, everybody's.
We had a Czech restaurant, right? Uh-huh. There's nobody in the Czech Republic for the most part eats salads, uh-huh. and yet we still had to have a salad on the menu. Why? Because of a business case. Because there were people who were our customers who came in and were on a diet or love salads or whatever the case was. So we had to have a salad. That doesn't mean that it's not something that a personal reason, it's something that is a business reason. I think you can separate the two.
I just think that if you look at the business reason behind it,
yes.
of every enthusiast loves wagons, every enthusiast loves V8s, and every enthusiast loves manual transmissions.
And the other reason we
and
buy
then Cadillac came out with the Cadillac CTS-V wagon, which was a V8 manual transmission wagon, and 500 people bought it. Right? This is the reality situation, is car enthusiasts love to complain, and then when it's time to actually pony up, there's always a reason why they don't buy it. Oh, it's got a 7-speed. I don't want a 7-speed. Oh, it's too expensive. I can't afford that, right? There's always a reason, and then you end up with no manual transmission.
Okay. Well, on that note, we've gone longer than an hour, Tommy.
Uh-huh.
And we've wasted it bickering away. Sorry about that. I apologize, and I hope that you found it at least somewhat entertaining. If not annoying, where should they go if they want more TFL?
Yeah, alltfl.com is the place to go for more content. And as always, it's been Tommy.
And Roman saying we'll see you next time. Ciao.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.